This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, welcome back to Full Time with Meg Linehan. I'm Meg. You are listening to a show all about women's soccer on the Athletic Podcast Network. Now, I know last week's show was all about digging through a PDF, but I'm really excited to do exactly the same this week. If you didn't see it, National Research Group released a new study in October called Leveling the Playing Field. It's a study with the goal of putting some real data around the moment that we've all seen around women's sports right now. So Jay Kaufman, Executive Vice President and Head of Sports at NRG, and Mary Machula, Global Marketing and Communications Director, joined the show today so that we can take the next step in thinking through what this might mean for the NWSL, the world of women's sports as a whole. But I was especially excited to talk to them about what they've reported about media rights, since that will be such a major topic for the league coming up soon. But before we get to the rest of today's episode, as always, to show your support of Full Time, plus get all of our women's soccer coverage and everything else The Athletic has to offer on our site and on our app, you can subscribe right now at theathletic.com/fulltime. Again, it's always one of our very best deals. And plus, right now, we are absolutely swimming in men's World Cup coverage across the entire tournament on and off the field. So it's always the right time to subscribe if you don't already. Okay, let's get into all this news here. The U.S. Women's National Team finished the year with a hugely, hugely needed win, ending a three-game losing streak, their first one since 1993. This past weekend at Red Bull Arena, they gave up a first-half goal to Germany before a second-half comeback earned them the 2-1 win. First, this huge stop from Melissa Neuer to prevent anything from a massive 2-on-1 chance from Germany that changed the momentum, and then Sophia Smith and Mal Pugh both scored in 2 minutes to give the U.S. Women's National Team the lead and the dub in their final game of 2022. I was actually at Red Bull, so here's some audio from the players in the mix zone for you. Let's start with the goal scorers. Got Sophia Smith after the match. I had actually just asked her about the high press getting cranked up to the max in the second half.
I just think we needed to find that extra energy, and that comes from within us. We all have it. We just need to dig deep and find it. So we knew we wanted to, you know, put them, you know, under pressure, and we did that, and yeah, it worked out for us. Yeah.
Can you talk about your goal and just the whole feeling of breaking the thing up between getting that goal right there?
Yeah, I don't know, like, I don't remember how it happened. I, like, blacked out, so I need to rewatch how it happened. I just saw it go in the back of the net, and obviously that's a great feeling, but I need to, like, look back on how it happened.
Just in terms of that celebration, though, coming to the bench, like, mm-hmm. It felt like there was a real energy.
Yeah.
Like, just what was that moment like?
I think, yeah, I just wanted to celebrate with everyone, because this team has just, we've been through a lot. It's been a long year, and everyone plays a part in doing what we do, so I wanted to go celebrate. I saw Pino on the sideline, so I ran straight to her, and it was just a moment to celebrate together, but also to talk, to figure out, you know, the next plan and whatnot.
Okay, next up, we've got Mal Pugh.
You want me to talk about that? I mean, I'm very tired right now. Like, oh my gosh. But I mean, I think it just comes down to just like working hard. And I feel like, I think I read something the other day that it was like negativity is contagious, but so is like positivity, you know. It's like pretty cliche, and I feel like that's the same on the field, is like your energy is like very contagious. So yeah, I just felt like I was just trying to run as much as I can smart, and I think that it was like a fire, and I feel like as a team we just kind of caught fire, and then we just kept going and we kept pressing and ultimately led to a win.
Just in terms of the high press, it really felt like we got ratcheted up in the second half. Just what was that adjustment in relation to, in terms of like what you've seen out of Germany the past three halves of soccer?
Yeah, I think, honestly, I don't think it has to do anything with Germany. I think it has everything to do with us. I'm sure that you guys have heard about mentality from my other teammates. I think that was just like a big theme going into this game. I think we kind of lost that over the last game. And I think that this team, that's one thing that you never lose, is that mentality. And ever since I was 12 years old and playing with the youth teams, like, that was just something that, like, I knew is, like, the USA mentality. And so I'm glad that everyone, like, we caught fire like that. We caught it again, and we were able to dig deep and just, I mean, that's sometimes what this game is. It's just digging deep and getting it done.
And finally, let's end with the captain herself, Becky Sauerbrunn.
Yeah, I think what we really wanted to see was a response from the first game. And we felt that, you know, we did a lot of good things, but when it came to getting the job done in the 18s, we didn't do it. And then so we wanted to respond well in this game. And then, of course, we go down and you really have a test of character. And I thought that we showed really well. We know that we weren't winning a lot of tackles in the first half, so we came out in the second. And I think the press was a lot higher, more intensity. I think we were getting stuck in a little bit more. We were interrupting more plays, and then we were hitting them on the counter and got two of those goals.
In terms of Mayer's save, it felt like a real momentum shift moment.
Yeah.
What was your viewpoint of that save?
Alyssa has proven herself to make one of those plays in the biggest games that I've ever played with her with, and that's what we need out of our goalkeepers, is to keep us in these kind of matches, and that's what she did tonight.
But this team really did not look entirely like itself in the previous three games, and really part of this half team. How would you assess where this team is heading into the World Cup year now?
I think these are the type of games that we needed to play. I think scheduling has been difficult for us. I think we've played, we've wanted to play high quality teams, and I think we've done a pretty good job of that. And then we played, you know, the best in the world these last two FIFA breaks. And so it was a good kind of like litmus test where we are in this moment. It's not good enough, and we all know that, and it's a process, and people are building relationships, people are building minutes together against high opponent teams, and we just needed this. We need to know what the intensity is like, what we need to do to actually win a game like this. You can't replicate what we just did out there in trainings. You know, like, we have to play these types of games, and so it's good for us. I mean, we don't want to lose. We definitely don't want to lose two, three times in a row, so to get this win is really important for us to know to what it feels like, but also to know what defeat feels like against these teams.
On Monday night, the players celebrated a big 2022, the CBA, equal pay, you name it. If you have not seen the footage of Rose Lavelle's Celine Dion performance, well, you might be living under a rock, but I can tell you that experiencing it in person was quite possibly one of the best things I've ever seen with my own eyeballs. One news item that did come out of the players' ball: Ashlyn Harris retired from the game, making her speech live in front of so many of her former U.S. Women's National Team teammates and Gotham FC teammates, and obviously with Allie Krieger watching on. A lot of emotions, but Harris isn't going too far. The next morning, Gotham announced that she has taken a front office role as the team's new global creative advisor.
It has been one of my greatest honors to represent this country. I started this journey with the Federation at the age of 13. I was a young, troubled kid looking for belonging. And I found that here. In a turbulent time in my life, soccer became home, the road became my safe space, and the people became my family. It has been an incredible run. I'm proud of what I've accomplished. But more importantly, I'm proud of the woman I've become. It's funny, when you come to an end of something and your mind is flooded with memories, you start to think of the dinners out with the gals, the shopping, the coffee dates, the hallway chats, the December vacations, wandering the streets of Portugal all hours of the night, Abby picking me up on 95 for an RV trip with Cruise America across the country to LA. You know, watching Jersey Shore with Sid in her silk bonnet and her Victoria's Secret lingerie, wondering what the hell is going on. Sister Pino never letting me order my own fucking meal for the last 15 years. The list could go on. You see, it's never been about the gold medals, the wins, the losses. Part of this journey has always been the people. So I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for loving me and pushing me to heights I never knew were possible. To my lifers in this room, you have been the greatest gift in this journey. You have kept me going all these years. You've inspired me every day to be better, to not cut corners. You have lifted me when I needed you most. And you were my oxygen when times felt too tough to breathe. I hope in some small way I've impacted your lives the way you've impacted mine. Thank you for loving me unconditionally throughout it all. You will forever be my chosen family. This will be home. To my wife, I owe everything to this sport because it led me to you. Thank you for supporting me and pushing me to be the best version of myself, both on and off the field. For putting me first all these years and never judging me because of my competitive fire. It is literally what I love most about us. We have never brought our competitiveness into our relationship. I would never be where I am without you. Always been a fierce force of light. I love you so deeply, Allie. To my children, Sloan and Ocean, you both give me purpose far beyond the field. I can only hope to continue being the best, most stylish mom in the world to you both. Mama loves you so much, and I can't wait to show up every single day the way you both deserve. So I leave you with this, if I can leave you with anything. Never, never, never underestimate the influence you have over people with the platform you've been given. Again, just never underestimate the influence you have over people with the platform you have been given. Continue to be champions of change. Let's leave this game better than we found it. Love to you all. Enjoy the night.
On the NWSL front, teams announced the current status of their rosters ahead of the official opening of free agency. And Kelly O'Hara wins the distinction of being the first ever NWSL free agent to sign with a new team. She's making the move to Gotham FC, but hilariously, we don't actually have contract details yet. At least at the time of recording this episode, we still don't. The NWSL announced the details for the 2023 NWSL draft. The league is going back to United Soccer Coaches Convention in January timing, which honestly, good news on both counts, I think. Mark the date. It is Thursday, January 12th, as I originally reported back around the championship time, but just settle in for a long night. Now, NWSL, there is still time to change the approach to timeouts, I'm just saying, but we've got the first hour of the draft on CBS Sports Network from 6 to 7 Eastern before coverage shifts to Paramount Plus and CBS Sports HQ from, you ready for this, 7 to 11 p.m. So 6 to 11, a 5-hour broadcast window for the draft. Yeah, I know. All right, also in the draft announcement, a new mechanism for teams to sign players under the age of 18. Finally. And a new mechanism means a new list. So welcome to the chat, under 18 entry list. Though in better news, spots on this list are not actually tradable assets between the teams, so at least we've got that. Here's the list of the rules with everything riding on the consent of the player as well as a parent or legal guardian. Here we go. Each team is limited to two under 18 players between its senior roster and the entry list. Players must be signed to a guaranteed contract within 30 days of being placed on the list, and the contract term must run through the season in which the player turns 18. Players will occupy a full roster spot. Players may be placed on or called up from the list at any time during the season. Players may not be waived or traded until the player has turned 18, or the team has received consent from both the player and the parent or legal guardian. Players may not be selected in the expansion process. Players must reside with a parent or legal guardian until their 18th birthday, and players must be citizens or permanent residents of the United States. And finally, last week, the Orlando Pride announced that interim head coach Seb Hines got the interim removed from his title. He's got a multi-year contract with the team now. He earned his A license last year while coaching the Pride. And when he was named interim, he was actually the first Black head coach in the NWSL ever. And now he's pretty much doubled up on that distinction as the league's first ever Black full-time head coach now, too. Along with the coaching news, Orlando announced some restructuring of the Pride front office, promising increased investment and resources, but this did result in the departure of general manager Ian Fleming. Moving forward, the team is opening up the hiring process for a new role, which is VP of Soccer Ops and General Manager. Before I bring on today's guest first, a few quick notes if you have not actually read this NRG study we're about to discuss. There is a link in the show notes if you want to pause and take a look at any point. It's considerably shorter than the U.S. Women's National Team Collective Bargaining Agreement document. I will absolutely promise you that. The study sets out to answer a few major questions. What increased attention on women's sports actually means if we're truly at this turning point that we all think we're at, and if increased funding, viewership, and interest can help overcome long-standing structural inequities. Here are the study's three key takeaways. First, fans are paying more attention to women's sports than they used to. Almost a third are watching more games than they once did, and as a result, the broadcast rights market for women's sports has enjoyed double-digit growth in most territories. Two, despite this momentum, there's still a huge discrepancy in how fans approach men's and women's sports. Fans tend to see men's events as more exciting and more competitive and are willing to spend considerably more money on watching men's games and buying merchandise from men's teams. Third, women's events can find an audience when they are given comparable airtime, funding, and media attention. This wave of momentum could result in a true breakthrough for women's sports into the mainstream, but only if broadcasters, sponsors, and policymakers are prepared to make the necessary investment. So, with all that, here's Jay Kaufman, Executive Vice President and Head of Sports at NRG, and Mary Machula, Global Marketing and Communications Director. So I guess let's just really start with, obviously there are some takeaways that are listed, you know, front page of this report, and there's kind of some good news here and maybe some, we won't call it bad news, we will call it areas of improvement that could happen in women's sports. But really when you're trying to get the message of this report out to the general public, like how did you determine these are the big three things that we want people walking away if they don't actually read this whole thing?
Yeah, I think really the whole point of the report was to kind of answer the question, are fans ready to embrace women's sports, right? It says that on the cover. That's really what we went in when we were looking at all the data that we had. I think that we wanted to also be realistic in where we were. We see so much opportunity, right? There's a lot of trends that are just happening in terms of viewership and people talking about women's sports. But we also want to kind of pull out, okay, where do those opportunities exist for the right people? And that's broadly, right? The leagues, the teams, the broadcasters. So we can really provide guidance on like, okay, here's the future opportunity. Here are the real issues. Here's what the great story is. And there is still a gap that we still need to address.
Jay, in terms of, you know, when you're putting together a report like this, I mean, really, obviously, it does go out to the public, but who are you trying to target with a report like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for this one in particular, it's everybody involved in sports, in the women's sports world, right? In sports in general. I mean, it's because I think it's a collective responsibility. You know, we've talked about this a little bit, but it's not one single group or one single entity that's kind of responsible for this. I think you're dealing with everybody from rights holders to the leagues and teams themselves to brands, you know, and to some extent fans as well, to kind of collectively understand what's happening and come together to make sure that, you know, that we're delivering the opportunities and you know, we'll talk a little bit about like supply and demand, but making sure that the demand is there, you know, or that supply is there to meet the demand when it's out there. So it's I know it's an easy answer, but it's collectively everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think it as just someone who's been in this space for a decade plus, right, and then in some ways been around it even longer, a couple decades now, it is I think it is a challenge because obviously there are a lot of people in a lot of different roles who all kind of have to be pulling in the same direction. And, you know, there might be differing priorities. There are kind of a lot of legacy people still around who might not understand kind of the moment that we're in. I almost want to start with this kind of idea of, you know, are people ready to embrace? Are we kind of, you know, one of the big questions at the front of this is, are we actually at this turning point? Because I think at this, you know, in women's sports now, I think turning point, breakthrough, like all of these words have now maybe lost all meaning because we've talked about it after the 2011, well, after 99, after 2011, after 2015, after 2019, at least in women's soccer, right? Like we get this cyclical journey every 4 years of big, exciting thing, and then we go back to a status quo. And like a little growth every time, but it we've seen it time and time again. The Olympics are very heavily featured in this report, and I think they are a very interesting kind of counterexample in terms of what's possible, but they are still a very cyclical thing of you get these heights of, you know, track and field coverage or women's hockey coverage, and then trying to build off of that can be really, really tough. But in terms of, you know, the viewership data that you've seen in terms of, you know, the desire and appetite to watch women's sports, I mean, what is kind of like the foundational stuff that you found out there in terms of the change of patterns of watching, but also even the desire to watch?
I'll start with one thing, and then I'll pass to Jay because he will probably have more. But I think one stat that really stuck out to me, and it kind of the same theme that was coming up over and over again, was in terms of the people who reported watching more women's sports, particularly, you know, in the past year, but also over the past 5 years, the reason that they said that, the number one reason, was that there's more being shown. And I think that in and of itself is kind of like, okay, the philosophy of if you build it, they will come, or, you know, what Jay was saying, the supply has to meet the demand. I think that if there is that incremental continued exposure, you're going to be able to answer a whole lot more questions that you haven't been able to in these previous times, because there just wasn't as many opportunities for the viewers to just watch and react.
Okay. Yeah, to totally agree. And I think the fact that we see, you know, in the numbers in the survey, like, you know, more and more people saying that they're more interested, that they're watching more, you know, especially when you look at some of the demographic trends in there, where you see, you know, younger people in particular saying, that they're, you know, that they're watching more and more engaged. I think that's that demonstrates that there is an appetite, and it's only going to grow over time. And to your original question, I think now it is an inflection point, because we know that that's there. We know just the way that kind of the media world is right now, like there's a lot of opportunities for, you know, content opportunities in sports, where there's, you know, more and more platforms that are getting into sports and looking at rights and trying to fill their, you know, their streaming services with content and so forth. And so in a lot of ways, like the opportunity exists now to provide those, you know, that coverage and those in, you know, the live games to actually watch for these folks that are that have built up this interest over time. And I think, you know, one of the things we'll get into this a little bit too, but like, you know, the difference between men's and women's sports in a lot of cases is kind of the inertia and the generation, you know, generational aspect mm-hmm. behind like interest. And I think, you know, it's going to be kind of a cycle here. If we can get the better coverage and you know, more games out there, and it can meet that you know, demand from the fans, that it's only going to, you know, improve over time, and like all these metrics across the board here will start to grow as well.
It sounds really simple when you say it.
Really simple, right? Easy problem.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just, hey, you gotta get this. But I want to talk to you about, there is this kind of, I think, bigger sports thing now too, where you have this trend of people going to streaming platforms, right? Like we've seen it with the NWSL, where there is this trying to find this balance of final on CBS, right? NWSL gets 915,000 viewers, almost yep. breaking a million, but then so many games are behind a paywall on Paramount Plus, or in some cases, the semifinals, for instance, are on CBS Sports Network, but not mirrored on Paramount Plus. So if you don't have cable, you're not able to watch them. And you know, you have kind of all these legacy leagues. Like, I totally agree with you. I was born into being a Red Sox fan. There's no, like, I'm from Boston. There is no choice about this. Like, it's happening.
I am as well. So we're on the same side there.
Yeah. So there is this kind of sense of so many of the existing men's leagues have this kind of generational advantage. And you look at something like MLS compared to NWSL right now, and obviously the media rights deal has gotten a ton of attention, but the league has also kind of had a two-decade, three-decade now advantage of being on television, growing a fan base, and now they're moving behind a paywall of some sort on Apple TV. And so there is maybe the sense of we have enough of a fan base here to both sustain us and then a way that we can still grow, but also we're getting an absurd amount of money every year, whereas the NWSL is in this very different boat of you still have to grow, but the entire sports world is trending in this one direction. But to me, like reading the report, like it still seems like for women's sports, the ultimate answer to everything about growth is still finding the widest platform and coverage that you can find. And do we just live in this tension forever? Is it just our easy answer of like, hey, you got to put more games on TV?
It's a balance, right? And each property is a little different. Right? And like you said, it depends on the stage of where you are. And even within men's sports, you know, we saw it a lot, the NBA, like, you know, NBA is obviously an established property. But when you compare it to MLB, you know, there's one to two generations of fans typically that are, you know, that MLB has over the NBA. And so the same holds true to women's sports. But I think the answer is it depends. And like, I think what you want to try to do is find a balance. I think having access to as many games as possible for those fans that want to watch is certainly critically important. But I think making sure the most prominent events in the season, you know, the championship game, like you mentioned, you know, there's some similar numbers when you look at women's, you know, the College World Series and Softball World Series and obviously women's basketball, like there's some huge numbers out there. And so making sure that the biggest games are on the biggest platforms are just from an exposure perspective, I think is critically important. So it's a balance between the two.
Yeah, Mary, I was hoping, you know, there is kind of this overall, and I've had so many conversations about this, but it's not even just getting the games on TV. It's then also kind of the infrastructure piece around it of knowing where the games are and how to watch them. And you know, we are so used to this infrastructure existing on the men's side of, you know, I mean, it used to be that you could check a newspaper, right, and figure out what time a game is and all that kind of stuff. But you know, you have to, I think, work really hard sometimes to figure out how and where and when you're going to be watching women's sports. And were there any lessons out of this report on that front of maybe what the path forward on that front is?
Yeah, so I think one of the themes that came up, and it was in the Olympic section, it has to do with storytelling and what happens outside of the broadcast moments. That can be as simple as, you know, an advertisement storytelling, or it could be something that's more in depth. Like we've seen some of the streaming services do more detailed storytelling on leagues and teams and all that kind of stuff. I think that having that, you know, tangible, emotional maybe connection to some of these leagues and teams, and then maybe you are taking that step to seek it out versus more, oh, I stumbled upon this.
Passive approach.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think let's talk about the Olympics because I did find that really interesting. I mean, as a soccer writer, the Olympics are always really interesting because obviously I'm trying to cover one primary sport during the Olympics, and it always feels like the U.S. women's national team, like obviously they do kind of have their big moments, but it tends to get a little lost, right? In the Olympics, it just feels like the floodgates are opening all of the time. But we have seen, especially in the U.S., this kind of real parity in terms of coverage of the athletes being balanced across the two genders. What were the biggest takeaways in terms of what you saw from viewership data from like just as a case study, I guess, from what we can learn from Olympic coverage? Jay?
So I think the main thing is that you know, when the storytelling, when the coverage, when the you know, the telecasts and the events are there, you know, and people have the ability to relate to the athletes, to the, you know, have like a vested interest in what's happening, then the viewers will come, you know, and there is every opportunity for women's sports to be, you know, as big over time, and in certain cases bigger than men's sports, you know, depending on, you know, what's, you know, what that event is, what the sport is, who's the athletes, et cetera. And so I think what we can do is learn from the Olympics and figure out a way to, you know, bring that storytelling, bring the additional coverage, bring the relatability of like these amazing athletes to other sports, you know, and other properties, and make sure that, you know, that playing field is as level as it can possibly be, to get people used to seeing these great athletes and kind of build that interest over time. So it's almost like the perfect case study as to like what can happen in some of these other properties if, you know, the time, the investment, the energy is put to doing that. And it's not an impossible situation here. It's very doable. Again, without simplifying it, if all these pieces come together the right way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we can use the Boston Red Sox as an example, right? Like when you think about the coverage of the team, not just within a season in terms of like the micro level coverage of game to game, where you can read a box score or figure out what happened, watch highlights, all that kind of stuff. There's also the macro level of storytelling. But then, you know, baseball offseason is still a time of a huge amount of coverage, but people are trying to set up storylines for next year, right? Like, is this reliever going to be ready for next year? You know, like there's an injury watch, there's all of this kind of narrative that continues and does not just simply stop at the end of the year. And that's, I think, where there has been really great frustration on the women's sports side of, we see these moments of coverage, especially around, again, major events. But the gap, right? Like, I mean, again, we can talk about this perceptual gap that is written about a lot in the study of, how do you, I guess my big question is like, how do we convince other people that there is value in that coverage when, especially I think sometimes like there is not that kind of instant reward, right? Because you get that instant reward in men's sports because it has been built over decades and decades and decades. So it works. That is not necessarily the case in women's sports. I mean, do you think that there's data coming out of this, or is it just kind of that leap of faith where people are going to have to make the investment and wait for it to pay off?
So are you talking from the fan perspective?
I mean, from like a media broadcast, you know, like all the people who are kind of in that media infrastructure of women's sports, right? Like a rights holder. So CBS having big, you know, pregame, postgame shows for every game potentially, or you know, like we get it for the big moments, but not necessarily in and out week by week.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers themselves, like it's a big part of this, and something that I talk about a lot is that women's sports should not be viewed as like a cause in any way.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like it's not a like let's invest. You know, like if brands, if whoever are investing, like. The point is that it's a good business investment. It's a good business case. Like if you look at, you know, you mentioned that the you know, NWSL numbers on CBS, but like, you know, you mentioned that the College Softball World Series did like 1.7 million mm-hmm. on ESPN. And that was like more than the Men's World Series. You know, like the NCAA basketball game, the women's basketball game did almost 5 million viewers. And like, that's
right.
Like, that was like the highest in almost 20 years. And like that, you put that up against almost anything in prime time, you know, like certainly any sports in prime time. And so like, I think the biggest thing on the media side and like, yes, the ESPNs of the world, like I think they've made a lot of, you know, they've made a lot of investment. It's very high on their radar as well to their credit. But I think you know, they wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't a good business case. Right. And so I think the numbers justify themselves. And I think when you start to like, dissect what's happening, and then you get again into the demographics and like who's watching. Like, there's a reason why more and more of these, prominent women's sports are like ending up in not just on the networks, but like in good windows and in mm-hmm. prime time or in key spots. And I think that's just because like they're performing, and so you know, as that continues to happen, I only expect there to be more and more opportunities there.
Yeah, we build on that just real quick. We called out in the report as well some of the segments that are like most latching on to women's sports. And I think just like any other investment, if you look at those groups, you see opportunity and you can target them in whatever way that you think is most effective. So there is that just like natural, here's where the opportunity exists and it's going to pay off for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think what there is kind of, again, still so much work to be done. I want to also sidestep maybe into a slightly different area, but one that I found this data to be some of the most interesting in this report, because there were the comparisons between people who watch men's sports and people who watch women's sports. And I mean, it went from, you know, like more exciting, all of that kind of stuff. But also the numbers that I found really, really interesting were actually about like willingness to spend money, because it almost did not line up with what I have seen in women's. And to be fair, I'm very embedded, right? Like, so I'm not maybe talking to the more casual fan, but what we have seen this trend, I think, across women's sports is that the demand for merchandise has grown so, so drastically, and to the point where they can't keep up, right? U.S. Women's National Team jerseys were selling, like, they were one of the best sellers at Nike, couldn't keep them in stock. NWSL has always, I think, struggled to meet demand in terms of jerseys. We're seeing this kind of growth in that point, but then the data in the report suggests that there is still maybe overall this greater reluctance to spend money on merchandise, on tickets for women's sports. And where do you see, I guess, that trend in terms of like maybe who are the people responding to that? But also, you know, is there a way where maybe both of like my anecdotal mind is maybe can mesh with what the data actually says on that front?
Yeah, one piece of that data point that I think adds a little bit of nuance, and there's nuance to everything, but I think those responses were based off of, you know, people who self-reported being fans of women's sports and people who self-reported being sports fans in general. Largely, there was a very big overlap between they were also fans of men's sports. So mm-hmm. I think potentially, you know, there it came as like a comparison question, right? You're looking at how much you're willing to spend on the men's and women's, and you're a fan of both. So that's just one level of nuance, I think, that, you know, it impacts that response there.
Right.
Yeah, I think like it can be simultaneously true that people are more and more engaged with women's sports, but still, when compared directly to men's sports, and for the reasons we talked about, that some of the generational stuff, like they still might not, the women's sports, whether it's spending, whether it's spending on merch, whether it's spending on media coverage, whatever it is, like it's still, you know, they still may not win out, but it doesn't mean that, you know, that's one of the areas where I think we would hope over time that like as you get kind of that generational element and you build ties with teams and you like build ties with athletes that like that starts to flip a little bit and mm-hmm. even now it's going to, that one's going to take a while,
right.
Obviously. But I think if you look at it in terms of, are the diehard women's sports fans willing to pay? Yes. I think now it's getting those more casual fans, like you said, or those people that have an awful lot of choices in sports and are mm-hmm. like, and maybe in some cases, limited dollars, limited time to dedicate to prioritize like women's sports in those cases.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has been interesting just watching kind of ticket pricing change even within, you know, the past decade of the league in terms of like what people were paying at the start and to where it is now in terms of, you know, you think about like Angel City FC and just saying like, oh, no, we should be right up there with the guys. Like we are a valuable ticket and you will get your money's worth, but you're going to pay to be here because it is actually like it's worth something to be here. So I think it has been a really interesting thing to kind of watch that growth of there's a like it's still, I think, more, you know, when you like look at those studies of how much money does it take to get a family of four into a game and get like a hot dog or what, you know, like I feel like I see those all the time and the prices are obviously like an NFL game is just kind of absurd. Right. And then you compare that to a women's sports event and it's always going to be, I think, a very different thing. But the numbers are, I think, kind of growing.
I think that makes sense. I think the environment in a lot of cases or perceived environment around women's sports is also significantly better than men's. Like, I think like that one of the things we found was that like just the atmosphere was more family friendly and there were less issues and, it was in a lot of cases like less commercial, mm-hmm. For better or worse. But I think that there are a lot of those, it's something that women's sports can take advantage of in a lot of ways. If it's like both the price piece and kind of the environment piece that like, and especially again, when you go back to these like youth numbers and kind of the younger population, like it seems like a better fit for younger sports fans to go physically to a game and kind of have the experience that they're looking for.
Yeah. It's honestly very fascinating to me because I think one of the big pain points, especially in women's soccer, has been like, it's not to say that I do think like Gen Z obviously is a huge target area, but I think there has been a real push to say, okay, we're going to start marketing outside of like youth soccer clubs, right? And to adults who can get there to a game on their own and can buy alcohol and can have a good time and buy merch and they have their own, you know, credit or debit card and can charge and buy things, right? And that has been, I think, kind of a culture shift in women's soccer kind of throughout the years in terms of, you know, I remember going to plenty of games and it's just the sound of 8 to 14-year-old girls yelling and it sounds a little different these days. And I think that's been a long kind of project in terms of, I guess, you know, I want to talk about this kind of big supply and demand concept here because you've got to balance getting people in stadiums with getting people to watch on TV, right? And how do you make both of those things as worth it as possible? Because I think they benefit each other, right? The bigger viewership numbers, the more stuff you're going to get, the more people in seats, the better it's going to look on TV. All this stuff kind of goes into the same kind of virtuous cycle. But one of the things kind of in the report that I thought was really interesting too is that when you surveyed people about like who they know from the world of women's sports, it's a lot of people who aren't actually playing right now. Like for soccer, the number one name was Mia Hamm, which honestly did not surprise me. But how do you get, you know, Sophia Smith to be a household? Like,
yeah,
all of this stuff is connected. So I guess how is the future of women's sports maybe a little more dependent on getting some of that storytelling, name recognition, all that kind of big stuff going.
Yeah.
Big project.
Yeah, I think it's actually one of the most important findings that is actionable in this study for all the people we talked about, the rights holders, media, mm-hmm. et cetera, brands. Like that's a problem, right? You're always going to have big time former athletes that make any of these lists. Like Michael Jordan still pops up on, you know, most popular athletes lists and whatnot. But like, you know, there's no reason why, you know, Roosevelt, Sophia Smith, Asia Wilson, like these are like superstar athletes, like the best, young athletes in the world. And like, it's a problem if they're not on this list in the next year or two or three or whatever it is. Like we're doing a disservice to them. We're doing a disservice to women's sports. If like collectively we can't build coverage, build like relatability, build exposure for like these athletes that like, are incredible athletes. Like when you, like any way you look at it, the skill level, the intensity, the competition, like all of these things, like these are like tremendous players. And like, while it's great that, you know, clearly the Venuses and Serenas and Mia Hams and they're going to have a place in people's minds and they should, but I think it has to be more balanced with like current athletes and like ideally like younger current athletes that like, people can spend the next 10 to 15 years with and like build those relationships. Like that's one of the most important things I think that women's sports can have moving forward is having these athletes that like everyone can point to and say like, they are the best. And, like we enjoy watching them. Like when's Asia playing? Like when's, that's whether it's on TV, whether it's in stadium, like they're special athletes. And like, you go to these games, like you know where they are in the field. Like you know that everyone's kind of like you know, they have like a spotlight on them. And like, you know, and I think doing whatever we can to adjust that list is really important moving forward.
Just in terms of, I guess, where investment might pay off the fastest, do you think it's, I mean, obviously there's a lot of data in here about media rights and viewership and everything, but in terms of investment beyond maybe just like if someone's going to acquire the rights to the WNBA, for instance, right? Like out from under ESPN, ABC, Disney, they said, you know, we want to put this on a rocket ship, right? Like, do you think that the data that you have seen and maybe the overall trends that you have seen presents kind of this a path to kind of accelerating the growth in a way that, you know, we're not going to be waiting another 25 years for these leagues to kind of be really like in the mix for attention? Marion, I know you're not like
I think, you know, there's just it's that same point again of everything around it. I think, you know, it's not just putting something on television, right? It's who do you have in your lineup who is really good at talking about the game, and who do you have, you know, going to the game beforehand, creating hype that way? What are you doing beyond that that is going to help build that storytelling, build those relationships, help create the inertia that already exists for men's sports and really get people to, as Jay was saying, grow up with athletes. I think it's everything around it, which is a big, big answer, but it is everything around it. It's not just putting it on the platform.
Yeah. I think all of that. And I think like making sure another thing that came up both in this research and in other work that we've done at Energy is like representation in general. And it's like, not just, you know, there's obviously the athletes, but I think it's, you know, there's points in here about, you know, referees and coaches and whatnot, but like, you know, commentators, like just making sure that like a theme that always came up, and it was particularly around female sports fans, but like, there are a lot of female sports fans and like, you know, and I think it goes across gender. It goes across, you know, all demographics. Is like, if you see people speaking knowledgeably and like in, you know, on the telecast in the stadium, you know, it just makes you more likely to you know, to want to go, want to watch, want to be engaged. And I think, making sure that whatever rights holder, whatever brand, whoever's doing that, like, has that in the back of their mind with whatever they're doing, I think is a really important piece to this too.
All right. I want to end with a topic that I think, so I did, I've done a couple surveys of NWSL fans throughout the years, just in terms of like checking in with them. And one of, I think, the best questions, and this is when I did surveys and let people like write in their own answers, which I will never do again, because when you get 2000 answers, you're like, oh, I don't want to dig through this. But one of them was, and this is a couple years ago now, so I think the NWSL has its own stuff, but like, what is the biggest challenge facing the NWSL? And an answer that got written in to a level that I would never have anticipated was just honestly sexism. Like, it was just straight up that kind of, you know, it's kind of not necessarily specifically called out in the report, but that is kind of the, I think, the root cause of some of the structural inequities that we have seen.
Yep.
In the sports world. And, you know, I think that there has been some real progress on this front, but I think about, you know, the way that I've had to cover the team and women's sports in general, like, there is still a lot of, oh, you can't celebrate like this. Oh, you know, like, Ashlyn Harris just retired from women's soccer, and like, you know, she did that whole live post from their 2019 World Cup celebrations. Yep. And the nonstop partying for essentially, I think, 72 hours, if not more. And there was, you get this whole like moral dilemma of, should female athletes even act like this, right? There's still so much stuff, I think, baked into this world. Inertia is maybe part of it. I guess, you know, is that something that we almost just kind of have to wait for it to go? Like, I think there's a way to push, but can kind of like, you know, I think about Alexis Ohanian, who's now an NWSL owner, and he's basically like, facts, not feelings, right? Like, that's one of his real catchphrases around the NWSL of like, we're going to prove our point and we don't really care what a lot of these people think about it. But how, you know, how can reports like this, how can some of the work and investment that hopefully comes out of stuff like this break down some of this kind of like really deep-seated structural societal, like, it's a big question. I don't think we're going to solve it on this podcast, but, you know, what have you kind of seen that in terms of some of this work,
Mary? Yeah, I think one of the things that was nice to see was that in terms of reasons why people are not watching women's sports or watching men's sports more, the self-reported responses, there was not a lot of like outright sexist comments. Obviously, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, but it wasn't what was coming to the surface. And there was a lot of responses related to, we want to see more women referees, like Jay was saying. There was a lot of responses that seemed like, okay, we're at least trending in the right direction. And we said in the report, maybe people are overstating how much they feel strongly about that, but at least they feel that they should be saying that. So I think that we're seeing positive momentum. I think reports like this can also just kind of like break down some of the maybe stereotypes that you might have had in terms of, nobody watches. Like, if right. you look at the data, it's there. If you, you know, look at what people are saying about the sport and everything, numbers are there to help counter that. So I think that can help with that aspect of it.
Yeah, I think a couple things too. So it was nice to see that across the board, and in particular with male sports fans, The general feeling was that they're in support of anything that will help, you know, whether it was legislation, whether it was like, you know, rule, like regulations that will help like provide the balance of, you know, between men's and women's sports and provide those opportunities. So again, like whether that's overstated or not, like who knows, but like there was really strong support from male sports fans that like, this is the right thing to do. I'm almost more concerned, you know, and we didn't get into this too, but I think there's also an interesting piece around people with their sports fans with daughters, you know, or mm-hmm. kids in general. Like that's and as the father of a 5-year-old girl, like I definitely feel even stronger than I did even when I was working with the WNBA and whatnot. Like there's a personal element to it. But I think the other piece that I'm more concerned about in some ways is like the indirect sexism or like the stuff around like the product itself and like the athletes, like that's the stuff that I think we need to try to keep an eye on and see. Like there's no the number of people that said like, listen, I think that like the men's sports are more entertaining, there's better competition, there's more athleticism, like that's the stuff that seems like there's some level of, whether it's purposeful or not, like, you know, sexism is probably too strong in that case.
But like a bias, right?
There's some level of bias. And I think you can't watch some of these female athletes and not question the athleticism and like question the competitiveness. And so I think as there's more exposure, it's a cycle, as that's the case, I would expect those numbers to balance out a little bit. But that's the stuff that like people shouldn't be questioning the product itself. Like it is in a lot of these cases, like, it's a very strong product. It's just a matter of getting in front of as many people as possible.
Yeah, and it's not just a matter of getting it in front of as many people as possible. It's also getting that kind of production value, right, that we're used to with men's sports. Like, I think that's a huge piece of it, too, of, like, does it look like what we're used to watching? Or does it look like it's being filmed on a potato? Because sometimes it looks like it's being filmed on a potato. Yep. And that's been, I think, a real struggle for women's leagues, where if the resources aren't there,
yep,
you're not able to say, like, listen, if you come to a game, you're going to be amazed. But if you're trying to watch it on a stream via a potato, like, it could be the best game of your life. And you're going to be like, that was terrible.
Yeah. Is there pregame? Is there postgame? What's the commentary around it? Like, what are brands doing around like the matches? What are, like, all that stuff is, I don't want to say more important than the live game, but, a big part of the puzzle for sure.
Yeah. All right. Any closing thoughts in terms of, you know, maybe where for folks who are listening to the show, you know, is there an action item? Obviously, like, they're not out here probably thinking about like, oh, yeah, I got to go out and buy media rights to a league. Right. But what is the role of the person who listens to a podcast about women's sports? Like, what, how do they get to use their vote essentially to say, hey, we want more of this?
You want me to go first?
Yeah.
So I think you brought up voting. I think it's similar in some ways, right? Like, I think it's like, in some ways, like, educating yourselves on all of the opportunities and options that are out there, and like, in making sure that you're exposed to as many different types of sports, types of games. Like I think it's a disservice to sports fans out there if they don't at least sample some of the properties that are out there just to see what they like, you know. And I think, like, you know, if people watch, you know, NWSL games and it's they're not as interested, or they can't get attached or whatever, well, you know, like, they'll maybe it's the WNBA, maybe it's whatever it is, but I think I feel confident enough in the product again that if people just take the time to build up exposure to the leagues, the properties, the teams, to the athletes, like, I think you'll find a better natural balance in terms of how you're spending your time, and you'll gravitate to the games, to the sports that are interesting to you, regardless of gender. And I think that's probably the piece I would say that everybody can kind of focus on.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Well, I definitely appreciate the time from both of you. And, you know, there's going to be a link for folks to read this report. Again, it's a much lighter read than the U.S. Women's National Team Collective Bargaining Agreement, which is, you know, 130 pages. There's illustrations, there's number, like, it's very, I think, approachable in terms of trying to read it. But yeah, I definitely appreciate the time and all the work that went into it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Meg. Appreciate it.
Thank you to Jay and Mary for the time today. Again, if you want to look through the study, I've got that link right to it in the show notes for you. For all things full-time, you can visit fulltimepod.com. There are links for all the major podcast platforms in one spot, plus more information about the show. If you'd like to subscribe to The Athletic and support all of our women's soccer coverage, you can do that right now at theathletic.com/fulltime. My name is Meg. You have been listening to Full Time with Meg Linehan. I'm still on Twitter, at least as of right now, at It's Meg Linehan. It's the same handle for Instagram, but I am now fully in Vermont snow mode, just as a heads up. And of course, all of my work is at The Athletic. Full-time does not exist without the work and support of senior podcast producer Michael Zimmerman. From The Athletic, I'm Meg. Thanks for listening.